This is Marketplace After the Bell. I'm Bob Moon in for Scott Jagow, and let's see if we can make some sense of what happened this week in business and the economy. It's Friday, July 24th. This was a week of tough medicine when it comes to fixing what ails the economy. Everybody agrees the healthcare system needs some tough medicine, and that's where the complications set in. President Obama is doing all he can to help the medicine go down. Maybe wrapping it in a name that's a little easier to swallow might do the trick. Then there was the bitter pill CIT Group was forced to swallow this week. There will be no quick fix from Uncle Sam, and yet life goes on for CIT and for the rest of us. In fact, things are looking up if Doctor of the Economy Ben Bernanke's prognosis is correct. Of course, much like in real life, you've got to watch your dosage or bad things can happen. For the economy, the worry remains inflation. Why can't it ever be as simple as they make it out to be in the movies?
For a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. Medicine go down. Medicine go down. Just a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. In a most delightful way.
Marketplace, providing you what you need to know about business and economics on air and online. Explore everything Marketplace has to offer, from explainers on technical terms to stories on personal finance at marketplace.org.
The story of the week, the month, and probably the year is healthcare. How to fix it and how to pay for it, but also how to sell it. If we've learned anything from the debate over healthcare reform, it's the subject and the legislation are incredibly complex. Overhauling the system requires trade-offs. Everyone hopes to gain, but no one wants to give anything up. And lots of taxpayers and companies are wondering, what's in it for me? Kai Ryssdal talked to David Leonhardt of the New York Times to sort out the economics behind healthcare reform.
Before we get to the legislation, let me ask you about the healthcare system itself. Why is it so resistant institutionally to any kind of change?
There's a really funny thing with the healthcare system. We see the benefits, but we don't see the costs. So healthcare is paid for by us. But it's paid for in ways that we don't see. It comes out of our paycheck and Medicare taxes. It comes out of our paycheck and insurance premiums. And that pays for the medical system. Then we go to the doctor and we get some treatment, or we go to the hospital and we have a procedure. We do see that. And so the services are very tangible. The costs are quite hidden. And as a result, what we want is more and more and more and more. But that is weighing on our wages. It's weighing on our federal budget. It's unsustainable. And yet when you ask people, how do they want to see healthcare changed, they don't often say, we need to make it more efficient.
There is a political question, many obviously political questions to be asked here, one of which is why nobody in this entire debate seems to be advocating for the people who are paying for it. That is largely households and patients and taxpayers.
I think the White House would argue that it is trying to take up that mantle. I don't think it's doing it enough. But the answer to your question is that there are very powerful lobbyists and very big industries for whom your waste is their income. And as a result, what you have is every time you propose something that's going to take some waste out of the system, you have a huge outcry, whether it's from the doctors or the hospitals or the drug makers. And what they do very cleverly is they don't say, hey, don't take our income away. What they say is this will harm people. And as a result, politically, Congress has not really been willing to stomach saying no to a lot of these parts of the industry.
With all the groups who have so much vested in this, from pharmaceuticals to hospitals to doctors to patients, how does the president cut through? How does he get a message out there that's going to stick?
He starts with the advantage that he's the president, and it comes that presidency comes with a megaphone unlike any other. And so what I think the White House needs to do, for that matter, the Democrats or the Republicans in Congress could do this, is they need to persuade people that the system isn't working now because it's too expensive and it isn't delivering good enough results, and that we need a form of change that will deliver those two things. And that is broader than just covering the uninsured, but it really is the number one issue here.
President Obama tried a little sugar-coating this week to try to persuade the American people the health care system needs strong medicine. In a primetime press conference, the president continued to push his agenda and made the case for reform. Here's how he started.
Before I take your questions, I want to talk for a few minutes about the progress we're making on health insurance reform and where it fits into our broader economic strategy.
Notice the subtle but significant change in terms. Healthcare reform has become health insurance reform, something that may be a lot easier for Americans to swallow. Reporter Tamara Keith talked to Kai Ryssdal about the speech.
Did he, Tamara, say anything about the timing of this whole thing? He's been very vocal about this August deadline, though it has slid recently the past couple of days. He started talking about by the end of the year. Any more information on that?
Well, he definitely did not say the word August, not once. he did, however, try to hold firm as one can without mentioning an actual deadline. Here's what he had to say.
If you don't set deadlines in this town, things don't happen. The default position is inertia, because doing something always creates some people who are unhappy.
And then this is where he started to open the door to delay, or at least he was addressing the concerns of Republicans and others who feel like it's moving too fast. And if it moves too fast, then you end up with a bill that isn't as good. And so this is what he then said.
If at the end of the day, I do not yet see that we have it right, then I'm not going to sign a bill that, for example, adds to our deficit. I won't sign a bill that doesn't reduce healthcare inflation so that families as well as government are saving money.
Yeah, on that point, Tamara, he said in his opening statement that there is broad agreement on what has to happen. Congress is still working through a few key issues, one of which is how to pay for this thing. Where are we on that one?
Yeah, it's just a minor little issue.
That's right.
And actually, he tried to downplay the significance of this. In his opening remarks, he talked about how two-thirds of this has been figured out. Two-thirds of the funding, he says, is going to come from other government health care spending. It'll just be cost shifting. And then he said, you know, the problem is that we're fighting over the last third. And there are all kinds of things that are being discussed. He didn't come down strongly in favor of any of them, though he did say that he doesn't want this thing to be paid for by middle-class Americans.
What about the political part of this question? It's economic in part, obviously, political in great part, and that is whether or not he changed anybody's mind. Congress is debating, lobbyists are lobbying, taxpayers are looking. Where is the conversation?
Well, he was trying to talk directly to Americans tonight. He said he was going to tell them what was in it for them. And he talked about a health care plan, a hypothetical health care plan, where health care costs would double over the next 10 years. People would lose their health care coverage. The federal government would be heavily burdened. The deficit would rise. And he said, you know, a lot of people would be opposed to that. And then he said, that's what's happening right now. That's the status quo. And I think he's hoping that message will get out to people sitting in their living rooms.
The president opened the door to delay, and that's what he got. The day after the president's news conference, Congress decided to take more time to get it right. Senate Democratic leader Harry Reid said the full chamber would not take it up until September. But the president hopes they'll keep on working to get the bill out of committee. Washington also handed out some tough medicine to small business lender CIT Group. Earlier this week, the government refused to grant CIT any more bailout money. Apparently, CIT didn't pose a systemic risk. And guess what? The company announced a $3 billion deal with its bondholders that will keep it out of bankruptcy. Is the bailout spending spree winding down? Tamara Keith reported on that story.
A big financial firm is in trouble, and the government opts not to step in. Then disaster. That's what happened when the Bush administration allowed Lehman Brothers to fail. Ever since, the ghost of Lehman has haunted the halls of Washington. Until now.
The administration believed that CIT just wasn't Lehman, that you can't rescue everybody.
Douglas Elliott is a fellow with the Brookings Institution. He says the fact that CIT didn't fall into the abyss, that its bondholders are stepping in, suggests the markets have stabilized enough that regulators can take some chances.
They don't have to basically stamp out any little fire just because it might turn into a forest fire. They can afford to let some things go and see what happens.
Elliott says it gives the administration the political capital to say no next time if they think that's the right thing to do.
They can not only make the arguments that they did, that this isn't big enough that we have to save, but they can also say, look, the creditors will probably work something out here.
maybe, just maybe, this means that larger financial institutions could be left to their own devices, says Dennis Santiago. He's CEO of Institutional Risk Analytics in Torrance, California.
We could get back to the normal state of affairs where companies come and go and do their thing in the normal free market process. Geez, that would kind of be nice, wouldn't it?
Only time will tell if CIT survives long term. It was another closely watched earnings week for the big Wall Street banks on the heels of really big numbers for Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan. But turns out Morgan Stanley didn't fare nearly as well. Lisa Roth reported on that.
Morgan Stanley lost $1.2 billion in the second quarter. There are a lot of reasons for that, including a lousy commercial real estate business and the cost of repaying its TARP money. But there's another reason it didn't report the kind of earnings we saw at Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan last week. Mark Lane follows banks at the investment firm William Blair. He says those banks took risky bets on the markets and made big money. Morgan Stanley decided to play it safe, and that didn't pay off at all.
They have pulled back their risk appetite in trading, and particularly fixed income trading. They're not generating the same type of revenue and earnings growth from trading that some of the other firms are.
He says that's partly because Morgan Stanley got scared off by some losing bets it made before the markets crashed last year, and partly because of poor management. The company recently announced a new head of the trading business. But some of Morgan Stanley's bad news is actually good news. Brad Hintz is with the investment firm Sanford Bernstein, and he says some of its bonds are worth more than they were 6 months ago.
Why does a bond go up in value? Well, a bond goes up in value if the credit of the company that issued the bond gets better.
Unfortunately for Morgan Stanley, accounting rules make it look like the company lost money on those bonds.
This is Marketplace After the Bell for July 24th. I'm Bob Moon. Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke had a busy week on Capitol Hill defending the central bank's actions before the House and then answering more questions for the Senate Banking Committee. He was back for more at the end of the week. The Fed has pumped an unprecedented amount of money into the economy to keep things going, and the prescription seems to be working. But as the recovery begins to take hold, the next concern is inflation. Bernanke is already thinking ahead and claims he has a strategy to keep it under control. John Dimsdale reported on that.
When the time comes to battle inflation, Bernanke said he plans to use a new weapon Congress gave the Fed last fall. Economist Nigel Gault at IHS Global Insight says the central bank can now pay banks to keep their money at the Federal Reserve.
By raising the interest rate that it pays on reserves deposited at the Fed, banks will choose to keep those reserves on deposit at the Fed rather than lending them out into the economy.
But here's the tough part. When does the Fed start using tools like that? Timing is crucial, and Bernanke was asked today, how will he know?
Since monetary policy takes time to work, the only way we can do that is by trying to make a forecast. And we use large amounts of information, including qualitative information, anecdotes we receive, formal models, a whole range of techniques to try to estimate where the economy is likely to be a year or a year and a half from now. It's a very uncertain business, but it's really all we can do.
Working in the Fed's favor is a prediction the recovery will be gradual, giving policymakers a longer window to get the timing right.
The other good news about all that money pumped into the troubled financial sector is that some of it is coming back with interest. In addition to paying back billions in cash, banks also had to give the government stock warrants or options to buy company stock at prices that were much lower than what bank shares are trading at now. Goldman just bought its warrants back. As Steve Henn reported this week, it's adding up to a pretty nice rate of return for taxpayers, more than 12%.
James Chesson is chief economist at the American Bankers Association. He admits that kind of return on investment might not hold up over the long haul, but
this is a big success for the government.
Chesson says by passing the bailout last fall, Congress stabilized the markets and made some serious money doing it. But now politicians in Washington have a new problem. How should they spend their windfall?
We are going to see more foreclosures because people have lost their jobs.
Barney Frank is the Democratic chair of the House Financial Services Committee.
I think a good use of the TARP money here, the dividends and interest and warrants, would be to lend people money until they get the jobs back. These would literally be loans, not grants.
Frank would also like to spend a few billion dollars allowing cities to buy up and rehab derelict properties and make investments in affordable rental housing. But Congressman Spencer Baucus, an Alabama Republican, is skeptical.
Those proposals have a human side. We know there are a lot of people in foreclosure. There's a lot of abandoned property. You know, if we were running a surplus, you could look at it. But Chairman Bernanke came before us yesterday and said, our spending is unsustainable.
And Baucus says with the national debt already above $11.6 trillion, any profits from the banking bailout have really already been spent.
Things don't look quite so good out west. This week, California lawmakers reached a tentative agreement on a state budget to close the $26 billion hole they've dug. But it comes at great cost. As Jeff Tyler reported, there will be painful cuts to school programs and health care for the poor.
Part of the budget shortfall will be covered by the state's borrowing from county coffers. John Elwood is a professor of public policy at the University of California at Berkeley.
A lot of the borrowing appears to be coming by borrowing from other levels of government, and they are going to scream bloody murder, but they can't do much about it.
As counties are forced to loan money to the state, they will have to cut services and jobs. President Obama has said that during the recession, when people are out of work, it makes sense to go back to college and get retrained. But California is dramatically reducing enrollment at its community colleges and universities. Stephen Levy is director of the Center for Continuing Study of the California Economy.
The budget cuts for higher ed are penny-wise and pound-foolish. Looking over the next 10 years, we're disinvesting where we ought to be investing.
The budget gap will also be closed by some fancy accounting. State employees will get paid at the end of each month so that the payment shows up on next month's ledger instead of this month's. That means the budget shortfall isn't really fixed. Instead, it's effectively punted for others to worry about down the line.
And finally, for all of you out there who have a credit card, things may be about to change. When you get a card, you agree to certain terms, including signing away your right to go to court. Instead, you submit to letting a private arbitrator settle any dispute. This week, though, the biggest settlement decider, the National Arbitration Forum, threw in the towel to stay out of court itself. Then the second biggest firm suspended work. Jeremy Hobson brought us that story.
If you believe that going before a judge will give you a better chance of winning your case than being judged by an arbitration firm hired by the company you're fighting, then you'll agree with Taylor Lincoln of Public Citizen.
It's kind of a good day. It's not just kind of. It is a very good day for consumers.
Lincoln worked on a study about credit card arbitrators and found that in 94% of the cases, the credit card companies won in arbitration.
It's the sort of thing that any fifth grader could look at it and see that all the incentives are lined up on one side and that the arbitrator and the arbitration company have no real common sense reason that they would be completely impartial.
The two arbitration firms getting out of the business are doing so because they were sued by the Minnesota Attorney General for hiding their financial ties to the credit card companies. You'd think that's good news for consumers, but it goes deeper than that, according to David Robertson of the trade journal The Nielsen Report.
Over time, it could be that credit card companies are fighting, you know, thousands and thousands of lawsuits. It would be like having little spot fires in the forest that you're trying to fight.
And the cost of that firefighting, he says, will inevitably fall on consumers.
There is going to be a rise in the cost of credit. Litigation is going to be extremely expensive.
That's the trouble with using tough medicine to solve your ills. It's never as simple as just popping a pill. You always run the risk of side effects, some potentially serious. And that's Marketplace After the Bell for this week. I'm Bob Moon. Scott's due back next Friday afternoon to help make sense of what happened in business and the economy.
One pill makes you larger and one pill makes you small. And the ones that mother gives you don't do anything at all. Go ask Alice.
American Public Media.